Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, this week marked 1 year since Illinois eliminated cash bail. It's the first state to do it. Now the change has been in place for a while and data is starting to show how it's working. We'll talk more about it and also hear from a judge who explains what it's meant in his county. Stateville Correctional Center is a deteriorating prison, so bad that a judge has ordered the state to move prisoners elsewhere. But for some who spent years on the inside, there is a range of emotions. It can be costly to have a baby, and many parents are unprepared. An Illinois family shares their story after medical bills piled up following the birth of their daughter. We'll learn about precision agriculture. It's meant to make farming more efficient, but some of the promises fall short of reality. And we'll hear about the price of farmland in Illinois and why change may be happening. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This week marked 1 year since the Pretrial Fairness Act went into effect, making Illinois the first state in the country to end cash bail. Many were opposed and believed the change would affect crime and jails for the worse, but the data shows otherwise. Patrick Smith spoke with Chip Mitchell, WBEZ's criminal justice reporter, Don Stimmon, professor of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at Loyola University Chicago, and Charlene Grace, a senior policy advisor with the Cook County Public Defender.
Chip, set us up. Why did lawmakers and advocates set out to eliminate cash bail in the first place?
Well, for a long time, black and brown people in Cook County and the rest of Illinois have been getting arrested in numbers that are very disproportionate. A lot of them were held in jail only because they couldn't afford bail. So it was a system that seemed set up to detain people based on their poverty. On the other hand, some very wealthy people who'd committed serious crimes sometimes, they sometimes could come up with bond money. Even if it were millions of dollars, they could come up with bond money and then they go marching out. So the idea was to eliminate money as a factor in whether a defendant is released from jail while awaiting trial. They're presumed innocent after all. And then the idea is for a judge to decide whether pretrial defendants are detained based solely on whether they pose safety or flight risks.
And that comparison that you're talking about there, where a person maybe accused of a lower level crime doesn't have any money to get out of jail, whereas a person who's maybe accused of a violent crime or something more serious, they can get out because they have money. That's why proponents of this change, they said this was actually going to make, this was going to improve public safety. Is that right?
Yeah, and there are other aspects about public safety as well. The idea is that, you know, allowing people to return to their communities, to their families, pretrial defendants, people who would otherwise be in jail only because they can't pay for their freedom. They don't pose a lot of flight risk or safety risk. Keeping them in jail means they lose their job. They're not available for their kids if they have any to help with childcare, to help around the house. So this has a lot of impacts on their families and the communities. Another factor is that the families have to post bond, and a lot of times they have to do a lot of fundraising for that. It tends to be women who come up with the money, aunts, grandmothers, and so on. So this relieves a lot of pressure on poor families, and in the long run, strengthens communities and lowers crime.
So that was the argument. Charlene, before you went to the public defender's office, you were with the Community Bond Fund, as I mentioned. Chip's talking about impact and pressure. What did our old system look like on the ground? I mean, how did the reliance on money to make pretrial decisions affect people's lives?
That's a great question. And the first thing I want to talk about was what the hearings looked like, because I don't think most people who hadn't been to bond court when we had money bond really understood that. We think that when you're arrested, we have a right to due process. We have all these constitutional protections. And what we want is a hearing that reflects the seriousness of that decision before I could be sent to jail, before someone I care about could be sent to jail while they're presumed innocent. But what we had was a system where a lot of hearings were 30 seconds long. They were 45 seconds long. At one point, we got them up to 2 minutes long. But now we have hearings that really reflect the seriousness of that decision. I think what we all imagined should happen, there are 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and they're concentrating court resources on the most serious cases, cases that involve the allegation of violence or harm to someone else. And at the end of that hearing, everyone knows what's happening. They know if someone's being released or if someone's being detained and kept in jail and why. Whereas before, at the end of a hearing, what you saw was a dollar amount. And in some cases, it was anyone's guess whether or not someone would come up with that money and be able to pay it.
Even something as simple as the bond would be set, but actually you had to pay 10% of that, which, you know if you cover court, or you might know if you've had a loved one go through that, but most people don't know that the first time encountering the system. So you talked about this change. Obviously, you supported this change. There was big opposition to getting rid of cash bail. People warned that it would actually lead to a big increase in crime. At an event last week, Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox said that opposition, that people who wanted to keep cash bail, she said it was basically racist.
What we saw wasn't policy disagreements. I kept seeing Kim Fox is championing this thing that everybody else hates. The fake newspapers that were going out that had black faces darkened. The notion of the purge, that people, particularly, again, if we're just looking at the faces that they were saying were coming for you, were black men, were going to come and raid your homes and all hell was going to break loose. It was rooted in racism.
So, Chip, we hear Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox there. As I mentioned, she was, in support of getting rid of cash bail. She's saying that the warnings were racist. But let's step back. What did opponents of this change, what did they warn was going to happen?
Well, there were a variety of warnings from prosecutors, police unions, and sheriff's associations, basically about tying the hands of judges to keep dangerous defendants in jail, forcing judges to release people. And, we heard talk about murderers being released en masse, from Jim Glasgow, the Will County state's attorney, that's southwest suburban Chicago. There were political mailings designed to look like legit newspapers that were sent to voters around the Chicago area that had, as Kim Fox said, faces of African-American men that were designed to look very scary. There were viral social media posts and even some politicians referring to the act as the Purge Law. And I never saw this movie, but I found out, I guess, that it's a movie about when all crimes
are
okay.
It's pretty fun, actually.
And even kids, you and I found out at some community events that even young kids in the neighborhoods were calling it the Purge Law.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this atmosphere that was cooked up, it soaked a lot of racial fears, racist fears, not unlike the ads. Some older folks like me will remember this. In the 1988 presidential race, George H.W. Bush was running against Michael Dukakis, and he released this very influential, very effective ad about a furloughed criminal named Willie Horton, who then committed crimes when he was let out of jail briefly, and that became very effective fodder for him and in his campaign.
And you saw mirrors of that in the opposition to ending cash bail.
Yeah.
So, Don, I want to bring you in here. You've been studying our court system. You've been studying bail and pretrial decisions since before this change happened. As we mentioned, there were people who had legitimate concerns and raised fears about their rise in crime. We had people who said this was going to make the system more fair. What have you found in this first year, specifically on crime? How has the elimination of money bond affected crime in Illinois?
I think it's a little too early to talk about the effect of the Pretrial Fairness Act on crime. Crime rates have long trends. We don't know what the short-term impact might be. We can point to some anecdotal evidence, though, right? So from January to June of 23, looking at that compared to crime rates in January to June of this year, crime's lower than it was in the year before. We can't say that that's due to the Pretrial Fairness Act, but we also know that crime didn't increase dramatically after this law went into effect.
Yeah, and I think all of us in this room know that criminologists like yourself, Don, would say you got to look at longer than 1 year over year. There are lots of reasons why crime goes up or down. But to your point, there were at least some people who said we're going to see an obvious and immediate impact on crime rates. At the very least, we can say we're not seeing that.
We're not seeing that. No, we're not.
And what about in the courts, Charlene? What is court? You talked about this a little bit now, but talk about Cook County courts specifically. How does it look now compared to, 1 year and a day ago?
Right. So the court is focusing more of its resources on the cases that people care about, the cases that the public cares about, the cases where someone might have been alleged to have been hurt, and the cases where someone faces a serious sentence if they are convicted in the future. And what that means is that people who will be released and who would have been released under the old system are being released quickly. So instead of booking someone into the jail on a $200 bond, that person's going to be released either from police custody without being held over and transported to Cook County Criminal Court of 26 in California, or they're going to go up in court right away and they're going to be released that same day instead of waiting for, as Chip said, their grandma to raise money or a bail fund, which we used to have but don't have to have anymore now in Illinois, to raise that money and pay that bond. As advocates, we have talked about that is a different relationship to building community safety and public safety than I think people imagine. Because people imagine, oh, we're going to create public safety by making sure all the dangerous people are in jail. There's an important conversation about who should be detained when awaiting trial. But the reality is that before the change and now, most people who are arrested await trial in the community. And most people who are booked into the jail before come back to the community and the neighborhood. But if we kept them in jail for short periods of time or even anything more than a couple days, what we know from the research and what we know from talking to people and their loved ones is that makes outcomes worse longer term. So if someone's in jail for 3 days, 7 days, they are more likely to be rearrested in the future. They are less likely to have stable housing. If they were employed, they are less likely to be employed by the time they get out. And so the less that we destabilize people's lives through these short stints in jail, which is what money bond was really doing in a lot of cases, the stronger our communities are. And the fact is we can actually reduce the rate at which people miss court, the rate at which people are rearrested in the future.
And let me ask you about the overall functioning of the court system. I mean, one of the concerns that I heard before this was a lot of cases get disposed of because people are in jail awaiting trial and there's some pressure on them to plead out. There were concerns that we were going to have a lot more trials. Cases were going to take a lot longer. It was going to burden our court system. On top of the fact that, as you talked about, and this was a thing that proponents of this wanted, detainment decisions take a lot longer. Are there just a lot more cases still pending because of this change in the law?
I think it might be too soon to answer that question about the pending cases, but I can say, yes, we are devoting more resources to these hearings. But one thing I hear from our attorneys in Cook County, and that I hear from even more, I'd say, in other counties around the state, is that diving into a case earlier, both for the defense and the prosecution, is better. And it's actually helping identify what's going on in a case sooner. Because previously, often the defense didn't have really any information when it was that first hearing and you're just setting a dollar amount or the judge is just setting a dollar amount. Now we're getting certain kinds of disclosures from the state early on. The state and the prosecution and the defense are learning it about a case. And sometimes, you know, I was at an event last week where State's Attorney Reinhardt up in Lake County talked about the fact that their review process that's in place now with the Pretrial Fairness Act helped them identify a young person who had been wrongfully arrested and who was set to be charged with a very serious offense. But because they are now reviewing body-worn camera, surveillance camera footage, they're reviewing evidence at an earlier stage in the case, they actually identified this young person was, you know, miles away somewhere else at the time of this offense. And that saved potentially a huge amount of harm to that young person. It potentially saved money for Lake County or for the agencies involved in that wrongful arrest, right? It's better for us to actually look at cases sooner and have more information as the case progresses.
And Don, you said it's too early for us to say for sure about crime rates. What can we say? You know, you've been studying this. I believe you're working on some research on it. What are some findings or what can you say about this first year without money bond in Illinois?
There are a couple things. One, there's wide variation across the state in how this was implemented. We have to remember there are 102 counties in Illinois. They have 102 elected state's attorneys who determine how they're going to use their power to petition to detain individuals. There are, you know, 102 different court systems that have judges that are going to determine how they're going to detain people after that petition's filed. The one thing we can take away from this is that there's a lot of variation across the state in how this has been implemented and the impact it's having on detention rates. So just to give you some idea of among defendants who are charged with detainable offenses under the law, the variation across the state is in some counties, 11% of those individuals are detained. And in other counties, more than 50% of individuals are detained. So we see a wide variation in how this is having an impact across counties. There are a few other things. I think it's important to keep in mind that, as was already said, this was the elimination of cash bail, but it's also the elimination of short-term detention for individuals. And we look at what percent of individuals are detained at that initial court hearing. In the about 22 counties where we've looked at court data, before the Pretrial Fairness Act, about 50% of individuals were being detained at court. That's across all offense types. Now it's about 8%. right? So the impact on individuals is stark. That's short-term stays of people who aren't staying in the jail 2 or 3 days. A large percentage of that, it's gone down quite dramatically from after the act.
So does that mean we're seeing a real impact on jail populations, overcrowding in jails throughout the state?
So what we've seen is jail populations across the state have generally gone down in the places where we have access to data. So in Cook County, it went down about 14% the population after the Pretrial Fairness Act. In other urban counties, it went down about the same. Rural counties saw a much larger decrease in their jail populations. Across rural counties, jail populations dropped about 25% after the Pretrial Fairness Act. That's probably because they were holding a lot of short-term defendants for short periods of time. Now, because of that has changed, there are very few people who are staying short periods of time. What we are seeing in a couple jails, though, is an increase in the number of people being held for 60 days or more, which is what we might expect, right? Now that people can't bail themselves out of jail, the people who were there are now can be detained until the duration of their case. So we're seeing fewer people staying short terms, more people staying long terms. In a couple jails, a slight increase in jail populations recently.
Interesting. And so that difference between, you know, fewer short term, more people staying for longer, is that a sign that this is working kind of the way it was supposed to, or the way lawmakers drafted it?
I think it is. We're seeing people who aren't staying in jail for 2 or 3 days. The people who are being detained are people who are there for serious crimes. They are staying now until the duration of their case, which can be several months.
And this sort of maybe it's not uneven, but the big difference you're seeing across the state, I mean, is that a policy problem? I mean, shouldn't this be sort of working the same way in every county?
I don't think it can work the same way in every county, right? The composition of cases in every county is different. We have a system that allows local jurisdictions to determine, based on their own local legal culture, how they want to implement this law and determine who will be detained. Again, the people who can be detained, it requires the state's attorney to file a petition to detain. It's entirely within the state's attorney's authority to determine who they want to file that petition for, and again, by the judge to determine whether or not they're going to detain that person once the petition's been filed.
That's Don Stimmen, a professor with Loyola University Chicago. Also, we heard from Charlene Grace, a policy advisor with the Cook County Public Defender, and WBEZ criminal justice reporter Chip Mitchell. They spoke with Patrick Smith as the state saw the one-year anniversary of eliminating cash bail. We'll talk with a judge about the change. That is ahead on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. As we mentioned, it's been a year since Illinois got rid of cash bail under the law known as the Safety Act. Now, if the state or county want to keep someone in jail, prosecutors at a pretrial hearing have to convince a judge the accused criminal should remain detained. St. Louis Public Radio's Will Bauer sat down with Chief Judge Andrew Gleason at the St. Clair County Courthouse to see how the new system has worked there so far.
What comes to mind is we had a monumental transition to make. Effectively, the Safety Act legislation changed the processes for the criminal justice system as I've known it throughout my whole career, which is almost 40 years now. And it meant that every aspect of that process was affected. I'm proud to say that all of those people cooperating and collaborating have made that transition effectively work.
One of the biggest logistical hurdles that eliminating cash bail put on the criminal justice system, that one could argue, is the extra workload that the local state's attorneys and the local public defenders kind of have under this new system. So how have they adapted from your vantage point over this 1 year in the new system?
You know, I have to praise the public defender's office and Kathy McElroy and the state's attorneys, but particularly the public defender's office, because they already had a significant caseload, and this was additional work. They have stepped up to the plate. They have been ingenious in some ways in rearranging their day-to-day dockets so that they have the ability to operate in the Safety Act and in this realm efficiently. So with that said, we still need resources.
So maybe one of the most common things that you might have heard from critics, I heard it quite a bit, was that the elimination of cash bail could make the state less safe. And the simple theory behind that is, you know, because people accused of maybe less egregious crimes no longer have to stay in jail under this new system. Judge Gleason, do you think Illinois has gotten less safe in this one-year sense?
I think you can make the counter-argument, too, in making the argument that those who perhaps were dangerous had the ability to bond out, had the ability if they had enough money, and many of those people did. The idea that we are assessing that level of danger to the community at large and or to any individual person before we allow someone to be out on bail is, I think the counter argument is probably correct. We're safer under this present system. And then and probably just as important is now we are upholding our obligations to the Constitution of the United States and the rights of us as individual citizens in this country. We are deemed to be innocent until proven guilty. Bond is only set to make sure that you appear in court. So the assessment of how dangerous they are to us and whether they're going to reappear for court is what we should have probably been doing all along.
So as we go forward, what lessons, if any, are we learning of cash bail and what changes or improvements need to be made here in St. Clair County?
Are people going to show up to court? And I think everyone who's been involved in the system as long as I have was leery of the thought that we're going to let people go with really to a degree with no catch to bring them back in. And surprisingly, the academics were correct. There is no meaningful difference at this point that we can discern as to whether you post bond or you don't, as to whether you're going to show up in court.
That's Chief Judge Andrew Gleason of Illinois' 20th Circuit, based at the St. Clair Courthouse, and he spoke with Will Bauer. A deteriorating 100-year-old state prison near Joliet is finally closing. Stateville Correctional Center is in such bad shape, a state commission study declared it nearly inoperable. But it's also become a hub for prison programming and education in Illinois. There are plans to eventually build new facilities at the same site. But first, member station WBEZ asked four people who were incarcerated at Stateville over the last half century to share their thoughts about the demolition.
My name is James Lenoir. I'm a student in Northwestern Prison Education Program. I just recently made a one-year anniversary of being released from prison after 20 years. My first memories of Stateville, walked into a cell and they hadn't cleaned it. It was roaches everywhere, when I say, like your skin crawled. But we didn't see it until we turned on the lights.
My name is James Soto. Most people know me as Jimmy Soto.
My name is Bernard McKinley.
My name is Stanley Howard.
I am the longest serving exoneree in Illinois history.
I'm at Northwestern Prisker School of Law.
I just completed 39 years of incarceration. I'm a Chicago police torture survivor.
I was in Stateville. I came there in December of 1982. So I went to D House and I remember going to Three Gallery and into a cell that really had this gray peeling paint on the wall.
Chip paint, rusted bars, roach infestation, mice infestation.
There was birds.
The jail birds. I mean, the birds literally lived inside the building.
They would defecate on the tables that you had to sit down to eat.
Discolored water. You know, the water has smells to it.
Some days you turn the water on, it come out brown.
When those bars and concrete get cold, it's like a refrigerator now. And when it's hot, it's like an oven.
Like when it rained in cells, it rained in the hallways, it rained in the kitchen. Like, that place was supposed to have been closed.
When Prisker alerted that he would be closing Stateville, you know, that was a relief because I knew a lot of other guys who had pre-existing health conditions that, you know, those living conditions were affecting them as well.
It immediately went from they're closing Stateville, yay, to, yeah, they're closing Stateville, but they're about to spend $900 million on building another facility. There's no such thing as a state-of-the-art doghouse, because a doghouse is still a doghouse.
People should really sit back and wonder, wait a minute, Can't we take this $900 million and put it in the front end to do things to try to prevent people from committing crimes by investment in communities, investment in public education, investment in the infrastructures of these neighborhoods?
I hope those brothers that stay real, even the ones that don't want to leave, or the ones that are concerned about continuing their education, I just hope those brothers understand that, you know, their health is more important than getting an education that they might not be able to utilize.
It's no matter where they hold you at, that count is what you do where you at. So don't allow them to make you feel or think that Stateville was the only place you could do certain things to educate yourself or get to your freedom or reach out to your family. A prison is a prison, no matter where it's located. It's just about how you choose to do your time.
That's James Lenoir, Jimmy Soto, Bernard McKinley, and Stanley Howard. The Illinois Department of Corrections declined to comment for this piece. It was produced by Lauren Frost as part of WBEZ's PrisonCast project. Also this week, a new autopsy report says extreme heat contributed to the death of a man incarcerated at Stateville. 51-year-old Michael Broadway died during a heat wave in June. Advocates say poor conditions and ventilation at Stateville were likely factors in his death. Remember, if you miss an episode of Statewide, you can find it where you get your podcasts and through this station's website. For the second time, the U.S. Senate has failed to advance a bill to enshrine protections for in vitro fertilization, or IVF. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois proposed the measure. The U.S. Senate blocked it in June. The measure failed to reach 60 votes again this week. Duckworth used the fertility treatment to have her two children. She spoke with reporters just minutes after she cast her vote. She called out Republicans, and specifically former President Donald Trump, for, as she says, putting women's rights at risk.
We know that this access and the right to get reproductive care is at risk because of Donald Trump. So while it may be convenient for him to claim that he supports IVF, we all know the truth. He is to blame. He and every other Republican who cares more about staying in good graces with Trump than about doing good for the Americans that they serve. Listen, I'm sure, and I've already heard it, and I know they're going to continue to do it, that my colleagues across the aisle will claim that their actions have simply been misunderstood. Well, to those colleagues, I say today's vote that's ongoing right now is your chance to put your vote where your mouth is, to prove that you believe that every woman in this country deserves a chance to be called mama without also being called a criminal. Because, you know, this is about our fundamental rights. I went to war to defend our rights and freedoms. I didn't do it on a whim. I did it because I believe so deeply in those rights and freedoms. And I'm not asking Republicans to head into combat to show that they care deeply as well. All I'm asking them to do, and it's really not that difficult, all I'm asking them to do is support this bill that could represent millions of people's only chance of starting a family. All I'm asking them to do is vote in a way that reflects the position they claim to have when they're spouting their talking points on Cable News.
Senator Duckworth, former President Trump has said that he is a leader in IVF. Is it possible for someone to stake out a position where they are against abortion but still believe in IVF?
Well, number one, he's not a leader in IVF. He's a leader in taking away women's right to make their own decisions about their bodies. That's what he's a leader on. He did that when he put three justices on the Supreme Court who voted to overturn Roe. That said, I think it's not about abortion. What it is about is the personhood movement. You can't be somebody who says a fertilized egg is a human being with equal rights to the woman who would carry that fertilized egg and also be supportive of IVF. Because fundamentally, the process of IVF will result in non-viable fertilized eggs that must be discarded. And that act of discarding those non-viable fertilized eggs could be manslaughter. So all of my Republican colleagues, Donald Trump cannot be supportive of personhood laws, personhood amendments, and also be supportive of IVF. The two are exclude one another.
Will Republicans pay a price if they block this legislation as they have done previously on Election Day?
I hope so. And I think they will, because I think the majority of Americans support this. I think the majority of Americans think that people should be able to start their families using assistive reproductive technologies if they want to. I think a majority of Americans think that military men and women, before you're going to be sent off to a combat zone where you may be severely wounded, should be able to freeze your egg and sperm before you go so that you can come back and start your families if you want to. You know, and I think most Americans think that if a doctor wants to provide medically sound reproductive technologies, they should be able to without being prosecuted. You know, this is the problem that happened in Alabama, where their Supreme Court said a fertilized egg was an extrauterine child, and all those IVF clinics ceased providing services because, every time a doctor discards a non-viable egg, they could be liable for manslaughter. Now, in Alabama, they quickly pass a piece of state legislation that actually doesn't solve the problem, but simply says that they won't prosecute, but they never actually dealt with the issue that is still considered discarding of a human being. So even in Alabama, their solution didn't solve the problem. And I think voters understand that, and voters want to make sure that people can start families across this country.
That's U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. She spoke during a virtual news conference this week with Eric Stock. Having a baby can be expensive. Diapers, the formula, child care, and of course, medical debt. Noam Levy brings us the story of one Illinois family and the medical bills that piled up after their daughter was born.
Heather Crivellari and her husband made a lot of preparations before having their first child. They saved carefully. They got good health insurance. They looked for a community where two public school teachers could afford a home. But when Crivellari and her newborn daughter Rita came home from the hospital, there were still mountains of bills to navigate.
It really felt like a full-time job some days, getting the baby down to sleep and then getting on the phone. I'd set up one payment plan and then a new bill would come that afternoon.
Altogether, Crivellari and her husband were left about $5,000 in debt. That forced them onto 9 payment plans to keep ahead of collectors.
And we had a healthy baby. I just kept thinking, like, what am I going to do if she does get sick?
Crivellari's pregnancy had been a little more complicated than most. She developed high blood pressure, and Rita was delivered by emergency C-section. But the Crivellari's medical bills were hardly unusual. New parents in the U.S. with private health coverage on average face more than $3,000 in medical bills that aren't covered by their health plan. And if there are complications, bills can run more than $10,000.
Even though they have insurance, they still have these very high bills.
That's Dr. Michelle Moniz, an obstetrician from the University of Michigan. She studies out-of-pocket costs faced by new parents. 100 million people in the U.S. have health care debt. About 1 in 8 say at least some of it came from pregnancy or childbirth. That's according to a nationwide KFF poll. These people also have bigger debt and say they are more likely to make difficult sacrifices, like cutting back on food or clothing. Dr. Eileen Atwood is an obstetrician in Rhode Island.
You feel bad because you know that they want the best for their pregnancy.
Atwood routinely sees young parents anxious about debt.
They are having to make real choices, and what those choices may entail can include the choice to not get certain services or medications or what may be needed for the care of themselves and their fetus.
For the Crivellari family in Illinois, the worries over finances got real when Heather was diagnosed with the preeclampsia. It's potentially life-threatening. She was moved from her local hospital to a larger medical center 30 miles away.
I do remember thinking when they insisted that I ride in an ambulance, I'm never going to financially recover from this. But it's like, oh my gosh, I want my baby to be okay. I want to be okay.
A state senator in Massachusetts says parents shouldn't have this kind of worry. And
when women don't get adequate care during a pregnancy and postpartum, that costs the system an incredible amount of money.
State Senator Cindy Friedman is sponsoring legislation that would exempt all medical bills related to pregnancy and childbirth from copays, deductibles, and other cost sharing. Crivellari says she wishes new parents could catch their breath before they have to start paying off their medical bills, kind of like student debt.
When I graduated with my college degree, it was like, oh, hey, new adult. It's going to take you 6 months to kind of figure out your life, so we'll give you the 6-month grace period before your student loans kick in.
Crivellari and her husband did manage to pay off the bills from the pregnancy, but they sank back into debt when their daughter Rita, who is 2 now, needed surgery for ear infections. It's all made Crivellari think twice about going to the doctor, even for Rita. And she and her husband are now firmly resolved not to have more children. I'm Noam Levy in Jacksonville, Illinois.
Stay with us for more of Statewide. We'll return in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. About 16% of the 300,000 English learners in Illinois are taking public school classes to become bilingual in both their first language and English. Few of those schools are fully multilingual. One of them is in Urbana. After years of debate, Yankee Ridge Multilingual Elementary School opened there this summer. Education reporter Emily Hayes spoke with the principal, Patricia Valente.
Every staff member is going above and beyond what their role is, and they're super stoked and super excited to be here. I just love being around like-minded people. It's really refreshing because I've been doing this for 20-some years. I started as a bilingual teacher, then a coach, and then a multilingual director. And being able to be in a building where we're all in a similar, have the similar lens that we're looking through education is really powerful. So in all of our staff meetings that we've met, collaborative work, being able to interact with each other, finally having, you know, buildings that were separated into three different schools now are all together. It's like a big family reunion. People are super collaborative.
How do you handle having these two main multilingual tracks? One is where students are learning English and Spanish, and the other people are learning English and French.
So far, we've only really been like in our community building with staff. So that's where it starts, right? That they're integrated with their grade level, they're integrated with teams, that each of them have a voice in communicating their thoughts and their ideas. So really doing team building and learning each other's, like what they're, who they are, and being able to value each other's person and being. And so being able to value each other's person and being, you are more likely to reach out. A lot of our teachers are pretty strategic in making sure that we include other teachers in conversations. Oh, don't forget so-and-so. Oh, don't forget, we need to include them. So like when you make schedules or when you do grade level collaboration, so thinking about like, do we have everyone at the table? And if someone forgets, someone else remembers.
The teacher shortage is most acute among special education and dual language teachers. What do you think can be done, perhaps at the state level, to ease that problem?
If Illinois can continue to fund alternative ways that districts can pay for education for TAs, for high school students, that would be greatly appreciated. And then visiting teachers has been a really amazing program that we've connected with. Teachers from Spain. There's other sponsors like Green Heart that also brings teachers from like Argentina or Dominican Republic. Having more sponsors and a variety of sponsors. Another thing the state of Illinois can do, provide the more funding that we can raise salaries to be able to provide stipends for the hard to fill. And we are doing that now in Urbana, but if they can continue to provide funds that can help support enticing or encouraging teachers to come over to get the training that they need or want is also really important.
That's Principal Patricia Valente with Yankee Ridge Multilingual Elementary School in Urbana. The Amazon warehouse in Edwardsville that was ravaged in 2021 by a tornado, killing six people, has reopened. The retail giant said the Metro East delivery station ramped up for business this month, roughly 2 years and 9 months after the tornado destroyed the facility. Amazon spokesman Steve Kelly says the exterior was completed roughly a year after the tornado hit. Since then, work has been done on the inside. The warehouse wasn't built with a storm shelter. That's drawn criticism. A shelter is not required by law. But this building does have stronger walls. Amazon also hired a meteorologist and reworked its extreme weather procedures. Precision Agriculture's promise to revolutionize farming since the mid-1990s. The idea is to give growers more granular data about their operations and new technology to put that information to use. Some of this has come to pass. Farmers have more sophisticated equipment and hard data on how their operations perform. But as Harvest Public Media contributor Eric Schmid reports, some of the loftiest promises of Precision Ag are still out of reach.
Inside the basement of an old brick building in South St. Louis, a small team of scientists make the final adjustments to a new sensor. It employs a powerful laser to determine the elements and even some molecules that are in front of it.
All right, target's in place.
Firing in 3, 2, 1.
This may sound a little like a rocket launch, but it's actually a prototype machine that can measure soil composition in real time. Pablo Sabrón is the founder of Impossible Sensing.
And every clack, 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 every light bullet that you heard gives you a data point.
Data points on nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, even water conditions and indicators of soil health. The sensor can be mounted on the back of a planter to let farmers see exactly what's happening in their soil as they drive through a field. Sabrón says that could help farmers apply the exact amount of fertilizer each plant needs.
The real value and the real need here is to give insights, give knowledge, prescribe what to do when.
Sabrón says this is the promise of precision ag, that knowing what's happening with individual plants will boost productivity and reduce the overuse of fertilizer, which pollutes rivers, lakes, and groundwater. But he says the hype hasn't delivered, at least not yet. And Sabrón isn't the only person working on it. Allison Doyle is an associate director at the Iowa State University Research Park. She says big ag companies are also looking beyond just seeds, fertilizer, and traditional farm equipment.
There's a trend right now in agriculture where a lot of the ag companies are positioning themselves more in the tech space than they are traditional ag.
She says labor is a big driver of this. There aren't as many people farming now than there were in the past. And Doyle says today's farms are much bigger than they used to be.
When you have an operation that large where commodity prices and all the input prices are where they are, you're looking for a tiny little bit of margin wherever you can find it. And so those precision tools become necessary.
But however promising new tools like that laser are, it'll likely take years for them to be adopted on thousands, let alone millions of farming acres.
Experimentation is a risk.
Bill Lee farms about 2,200 acres of corn and soybeans with his brother in central Illinois. Since he started farming in 1982, he says he's slowly added more precision tools to make his operation more efficient, whether applying fertilizer or planting seeds.
It's not a jump in with both feet, it's a process, because it's just too expensive and there's too much at risk to take that flying leap and realize there's not a high jump pit at the end, it's a piece of concrete.
Lee says he's more than willing to spend money on new technology, as long as he sees an economic return. It's a financial equation many farmers are familiar with. Chad Zimmerman, agri-food director at the nonprofit BioSTL in St. Louis, says it's unfair to expect farmers to be the only ones to bear the financial uncertainty that can come with changing their practices.
We can't be asking them to take on more risk, to just take a decrease in their profit to accomplish somebody else's goal.
Zimmerman says new agricultural technology can help growers, but it won't fully deliver the cost and environmental benefits until scaled across millions of acres. Impossible Sensing's Sabrón says that means big and small companies have to be the ones to prove their precision ag tech really works.
It's on us, right, to really create that value and show it.
He says once farmers see that value demonstrated, they'll adopt those new practices en masse, which is what he expects will happen with his new sensor in a few years. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Eric Schmid in St. Louis.
The price of farmland in Illinois has soared in recent years, but there are signs that is changing. Charlie Schlinker explains.
The Illinois Society of Professional Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers reports the feel of the market is noticeably more cautious than the previous, quote, euphoria. The average price for the region that includes McLean, Tazewell, and Woodford counties was more than $16,000 per acre for high-quality land last year. High prices continued with a couple of sales in Tazewell County that approached a whopping $23,000 an acre. One in McLean County came in at $20,000 an acre. Across the state, overall values were up last year, though some regions had downturns. The Society says the variability hadn't happened in some years. Ag bankers and farm auctioneers like Dave Klein of First Mid Ag Services in Bloomington say they have seen prices plateau in the first half of this year.
We try to keep track of the arm's length transactions that are public sales, mainly in the northern two-thirds of the state of Illinois, which is our major footprint area. We've noticed that land prices are down about 3%.
Klein says most agree there are single-digit decreases across the Midwest. Several factors contribute to the years and years of price run-ups. Kevin Burlingmeyer, senior vice president of Heartland Bank and Trust Company, says one of those drivers is institutional investors.
People were pulling money out of the stock market, so investors and you know, people that had a lot of money in the stock market thought, you know, the stock market's doing pretty well here. I'm going to harvest some of my profits and put it in farmland as a hedge against inflation. So there was all kinds of buyers, and that just really ramped that up, along with the price of corn and soybeans going up.
Burlingmeyer says the price of commodities has now dipped substantially.
Cash flows are tight. Farmers were making really good money 2 years ago, and now it's a struggle to, in some cases, to break even.
Meanwhile, fertilizer and other input costs have tripled in some cases. Burlingmeyer says greater global competition and worldwide supply may keep corn and bean prices down for a while. In the 1990s and early 2000s, one of the forces driving farmland prices upward was explosive development in the Chicago suburbs. Farmers would sell their land at a premium for housing or business development as cities encroached into previous agriculture areas. The federal government allows owners to avoid capital gains taxes on the sale if the sellers turn around and buy new farmland within a short time. Those flush with development cash would sometimes turn to land for sale in central Illinois and outbid potential local buyers. Burlingmeyer says there is still some of that money on the market, but not as much in central Illinois. Dave Klein of First Mid Ag Services says high interest rates could cut both ways in affecting farmland prices. Higher rates and low operating income may make it less possible for farmers to expand their holdings. High rates might also make some owners more willing to sell.
We could see, you know, more land coming to the market this fall. There's some folks that maybe are even leveraged a little bit that have said, well, I'd be willing to sell a piece or two if I could rent it back. And so that would reduce my debt load and improve my balance sheet, give me a little more working capital to work with.
Working capital is more important than usual just now because interest rates are up not only for land purchases, but for the operating notes that allow farmers to buy seed and fertilizer. Klein says the debt service to put in a crop is a lot more than it was 3 or 4 years ago. Heartland Bank's Kevin Burlingmeyer says the situation is kind of like a wedding reception. Sometimes you have a full house, other times people haven't RSVP'd and you're left nervously hoping they show up because there is all this food on the table.
There's just a lot less hands in the air at an auction than there were 3 or 4 years ago, even 2 years ago.
Farm auctioneer Don Meyer says you have to go out and recruit such buyers. You always want two or three potential buyers.
Your most important bidder is your backup bidder, your runner-up. And if there's no competition, then the auction stops.
And if that doesn't work, there is a fallback.
Generally, what you do is what's it going to take to buy the land. And that's when, as an auctioneer, you would say, well, you know, we're going to have an offer above a certain level. And if they're in agreement, then it's done. I've had those happen before where you sell it the same day, but quietly after the auction.
Kevin Burlingmeyer of Heartland Bank says that's not to say there are no buyers.
It just depends on who the neighbors are when you have a sale. You know, if somebody's driven by that farm for 50 years or 60 years, or they've owned the piece next to it and they're going to have one chance in their lifetime to buy it, they'll make a really strong effort to buy it.
The modest dip in land prices in the first half of this year may deepen late in the year. Burlingmeyer says that's because farm leases are negotiated then, and that will have to reflect the low commodities prices.
Cash rent prices obviously probably will have to come down some. And as they come down, that's less of a return the investors get. So you might see a little dip in farmland, in my opinion. But, I mean, farmland has actually held up better than I guess I thought it would have.
There are some counter pressures to the downward trend, too. Annual returns based on income may be low compared to the stock market, but Burlingmeyer says that's deceiving. If you look at appreciation and income, he says the annual return is about 8%, comparable to other investments.
Farmland's like a gold with a dividend, right? So you get appreciation, plus you get the dividend, which is going to be your cash return on the farmland.
In fact, farmland prices have tracked fairly closely with inflation over several decades. Dave Klein of First Mid Ag says that hedge against inflation tends to prop up sale prices. Klein thinks farmland will stay attractive to institutional investors such as real estate firms and pension funds, even more so if inflation shows signs of being stickier. Historically, he says farmland prices are closely tied to inflation because it's tightly held.
It's just the scarcity and the utility of it. The fact that when you have several people chasing something that is very limited in supply, inflation occurs. We only sell 1-2% of farmland in any given year.
The number of sellers has gone down a little bit, but not as much as you might expect. You'd think the number of sellers would also fall if the price is not likely to rise, but most sales are from estates, when heirs either need to sell to pay estate taxes, or they live elsewhere and don't want to have a farm. And that number's fairly steady. So while farmland may continue to soften for a while, no one is projecting a huge downturn. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
We're out of time for Statewide. Join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.